Hello, I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us. And it's time for All Things Political. Our guest today is Matt Rothschild. He's the senior editor of the Progressive Magazine and a frequent commentator on national news and civil liberties. We have a full slate of topics to cover, and we hope you'll join in at a different number than usual. We're broadcasting out of our Madison studios today, so the number to call is 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email questions and comments to talk@wpr.org or post them on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. Matt Rothschild, thanks so much for joining us today.
Hey, Judith, it's my pleasure. It's great to see you.
Well, we're so glad to have you with us today, and I'm sure, as usual, Monday brings lots of things to talk about in the news. One of the big items that really caught my eye was a new comprehensive Harvard University study was released last week. It found pretty interesting things about the income gap and economic mobility in the U.S. They found that it's no harder to climb the economic ladder of the U.S. today than it was 20 years ago. Is that a surprise to you?
It was kind of surprising to me because there have been other studies out that showed that we're the least mobile, and maybe we still are, but the least mobile society of advanced industrial countries, that it's much easier for someone in England or France or in Norway or in Belgium or in Sweden to get to a different spot on the ladder, that at least upwards than they start with. But here in the United States, it's very hard to move. It may not be that much harder to move than it was a few years ago, according to this latest Harvard study, but it's still pretty hard to move here in the U.S.
Actually, what you just mentioned, they did find that an American born at the bottom of that ladder has about an 8% chance of rising to the top, whereas the odds are twice as good as in Denmark. So along with what you were saying, that maybe things haven't changed that much, but it's still not easy.
And it kind of belies just a central myth of the United States, and that is that anyone who tries hard can get ahead, or the myth of equality of opportunity. People in the United States kind of don't want to talk about equality of outcomes, you know, that might be socialist, but at least we have equality of opportunity. Do we really have equality of opportunity here? To someone who's born in a really impoverished part of the country, who may be a minority, who may be a member of a single family, whose mom's got to, you know, work three jobs and isn't home to tuck the kid in at night, does that person have the same opportunity? Is it logical to assume that a kid who is from upper-class parents, whose both kids are doctors or professors and have, you know, tutors at home for them every night just with their parents mm-hmm. being there? I mean, when you look at it, this idea, I mean, it's a hope, it's a wish, it's a fantasy. It would be great if we did have it, but we just don't have equality of opportunity here. And I think this study demonstrates that yet again.
They did say that there are significant differences geographically. They say that rates of advancement in, say, Seattle, Washington, D.C., San Francisco, metro areas are much closer to that mobility that is often more likely found in European countries, but that many parts, they specify the Southeast and the Rust Belt look more like the developing world. So that gap is much more significant for, as you said, people who are starting out even more disadvantaged. Do you see any hope from either main political party in addressing the economic mobility, the issue of that gap? And should we see that gap as big a problem as some people say?
Oh, I think it's a real big a problem. It's a huge problem here in this country, and we need to do something. It gets to the moral issue of fairness, the moral issue of justice, and basically, fairness is kindness. You know, is this a kind society that doesn't let people rise above their status that they inherited from their parents and from their circumstances that they had no control over? So, yeah, I think it's a problem. The president has started to talk about this problem, has started to talk in his speeches, and I suppose he will talk about it tomorrow night. At least that's what the leaks are saying in his State of the Union speech. That he'll talk about the problem of income inequality, wealth inequality, the inability of many people in this country to move ahead, even if they're working very hard at it. And I do think it's corrosive of a democratic ethos if you don't let people get ahead who are doing absolutely everything right, and they're just you know, spinning their wheels.
A couple of weeks ago, actually, on All Things Political, Ovik Roy from the Manhattan Institute said that he didn't think that anyone had a problem with wealthy people being wealthy. It was really how well the less wealthy people were doing that was the issue. Do you agree with that? Does it not matter if there are some people that are just really, really, really wealthy in our society?
Well, I used to think that, you know, as long as we raise the floor, it doesn't matter how high the ceiling is. And on some basic level, it appeals to me because as long as no one's suffering, as long as everyone has a decent place to live and a decent amount of food to eat and a decent income so that they don't have a gun at their head and getting out in the workplace and having to work for a horrible a boss with terrible pay, then that's okay. But the problem is when you have a ceiling that is unlimited and that there's no upper limit on how much people can own or earn, it distorts our political system. The economic inequality leads to political inequality. It leads to essentially disenfranchisement. We don't really have one person, one vote in this country, except in the most formal way. When you have the top 1% and fractions of the top 1% giving so much to distort our political process, it really makes you see that economic inequality is having this spillover corrosive effect into our political system.
If suddenly someone was able to wave a magic wand and create really meaningful campaign finance reform, do you think that would change how important it is that the top earners or the wealthiest people have that much more money?
Yeah, I certainly believe that we need full public financing of elections here. We need to amend the Constitution. This is a big ticket item. Amend the Constitution to say once and for all that corporations are not persons and people, and money is not speech. Corporations aren't persons. Money is not speech. Pretty basic, self-evident things, but the Supreme Court and infamously Citizens United, but in other cases has said that corporations are people and that money essentially is speech and that we can't do anything about that. And I think at some point soon this court, if it follows the precedent of Citizens United, is going to say individuals can give unlimited amounts directly to candidates, because that's the logic of the position in Citizens United, that we just cannot do anything that limits free speech. And when you say money is speech, then is limiting the amount of money that any person or corporations can give to any candidate. Right now, under Citizens United, you have to say you're giving money to a so-called independent group, and it's not supposed to coordinate with the candidate, and that coordination happens all the time. Even if it didn't happen, it would still be greatly distorting because the people with the most money can give to these independent groups who can spend money buying ads, and those ads have tremendous influence. And then the little person out there who doesn't have $2,000, $20,000, $250,000, $2 million, or the Koch brothers are spending tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars on elections, that person doesn't have the same powers, democratic power, the same voting power as the Koch brothers.
We are talking with Matt Rothschild. He's senior editor of the Progressive Magazine and a frequent commentator on national news and civil liberties. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn for All Things Political, and we would love to have you join our conversation. You can call 1-800-642-1234. That's a little different number than usual. We are broadcasting out of Madison today. Again, 800-642-1234. You can also email your questions and comments to talk@WPR.org or post them on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you whether you think this is good news, no news, bad news about the income gap in America. Apparently, it's no harder to climb the economic ladder, but does that just mean that the ladder is just as inaccessible as it was 20 years ago? We also want to hear what other news you've been tracking this week, and we would love to have you join us. And actually, we do have a caller on the line, and I think he'd like to comment on what we are talking about right now with wealth and political power. We will go to that caller in just a moment. Matt, you said that Citizens United, you know, really kind of started this whole chain of events. Is there any realistic hope of Citizens United being repealed or changed?
Oh, I sure think so. There's a chicken and egg problem in that the politicians were elected in this old system of dirty money. At some point, you have to vote to get rid of the dirty money. But look, the vast majority of Americans, including the vast majority of Republicans, thought that Citizens United was a horrible decision. According to one poll, 70 or 75% of Republicans disagreed with that decision, and even more Democrats did. So I think there's a popular base for amending the Constitution and saying, you know, money isn't speech and corporations aren't persons. I mean, it's obvious to people. People understand in poll after poll over decades of time that big business has too much power, not only over our economy, but over our political system. And so there's that understanding, common sense understanding at the grassroots. And it's just a problem of our democratic system that the common sense understanding isn't translated into policy. But I think we can translate this into policy. And here, what we need really to do, rather than wait for Supreme Court justices to resign or die at an appropriate time, depending on your political affiliation, to amend the Constitution and say what we really believe.
Let's go to Willem in Colfax. Hi, Willem.
Hi. I agree with what Matt is saying about money in politics. I think it's, you know, until that changes, until the people are represented by representatives who are interested in their interests, I mean, the people's interest, instead of well, I wanted to give an example of that, and that was the Senate Bill 349, which is being amended, and it had to do with local control, which is a center point of Republican ideology, local control. They were willing to end local control, and the only really people that benefited was non-metallic mining. And the bill, you know, it's an example of how money creates political influence. One of the things I wanted to point out was this is what was in the bill, that the town or county government would have to prove, this is talking about road damage, would have to prove that the road damage was done willfully or intentionally or as a result of an unlawful act. In other words, I have to support the sand mining industry. They're using a road, you know, hundreds of trucks, and then we have to prove that that's somehow affecting the road. And how does that benefit me? And I think that's just an example of how our government is not working in you know, what they should be doing is creating great schools, a clean environment, and you know, a wonderful place to live. The kind of, you know, but that's not what they're involved with. This is, we don't even charge the sand mining industry a per ton fee, and we're giving them a 2-year tax moratorium. So we're subsidizing this, you know, rape of our landscape. And I think, how does that benefit us?
All right, Willem, thanks for that call. Matt, did you want to respond?
Well, I agree with Willem here because the laws here in Wisconsin, we're just seeing this terrible thing happen under the Walker administration, that the special interests are writing our legislation. They're writing our legislation when it comes to sand mining, as Willem says. They're, you know, the GTEC iron mine company wrote the mining bill. And then we had the ludicrous case of the guy who wanted to not pay child support, writing his own bill there, that if it hadn't been exposed by D. Hall over at the Wisconsin State Journal, maybe that would have become law by now. I mean, that's amazing. That this is the kind of special interest politics that Robert La Follette decried more than 100 years ago in this state, and it's back in spades.
We are talking with Matt Rothschild. He is the senior editor of the Progressive Magazine, a frequent commentator on national issues, international issues, state issues, and civil liberties. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn on All Things Political. We'd love to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. Again, 800-642-1234. Coming up, we are going to be looking at the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board saying that the NSA phone data program is illegal and should end. We'll talk about what came out of the RNC meetings and much more. Stay tuned. Right now, we are talking with Matt Rothschild, senior editor of the Progressive Magazine. We are talking about all things political, taking a look back at the week in politics and encouraging your calls at 1-800-642-1234. Matt, the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board said this week that the NSA phone data program is illegal and should end. That's a panel that was put together by the 9/11 Commission. And they said that the section of the Patriot Act on which the program was built and which was used for justification for it, quote, does not provide an adequate basis to support this program. How significant is that?
Well, it's pretty significant, I think. Though there's a real conflict going on in the courts right now, because you have one federal district court saying it's unconstitutional, and another judge in another court saying it is constitutional, and so it's going to go to the Supreme Court, and they'll have to hash that one out. But it's blatantly unconstitutional, if you ask me, because it's a violation, clear violation of the Fourth Amendment, which says we need to be secure in our persons, papers, houses, and effects. And there needs to be probable cause, and there needs to be a search warrant. Well, there's not a search warrant. There's not probable cause, and we're not secure in our persons, papers, house, and effects. If the NSA can grab every one of our phone calls, it's also grabbing our keystrokes on our computers and our smartphones, too. And this is just a vacuum cleaning operation. They're sucking everything up here, and there's no predicate of criminal wrongdoing or even a suspicion of criminal wrongdoing on the millions and millions of Americans whose phone records the NSA is grabbing. It's straight out of Orwell's 1984, and it's not legitimate under the Patriot Act, under Section 215 of the Patriot Act, which is the sometimes called the bookstore librarian part of the act, where you can go into a bookstore if you're the FBI and demand the records of everyone who's checked out a book and who's checked out what book, or go into the library and do the same, and then put a gag in the mouth of the librarian and the bookstore owner, mm-hmm. so that no one can know what's happened, which is really a scary kind of phenomenon. And my hat's off to all the librarians who have fought this Section 215 of the Patriot Act for the last, what is it now, 10 years almost.
Right.
So more than 10 years, I guess. And so I do hope that the U.S. Supreme Court, and this is going to sound goofy, overturns it. The goofiness is that I think Antonin Scalia, of all people, may come out against this, because sometimes he sides with the executive branch, and sometimes he actually has a libertarian part of him that responds hostily to these overreaches by the executive branch.
So the panel, which was not unanimous in that decision, but they concluded that the program raises serious threats to civil liberties, which you just addressed, but it also said that the NSA data collection has shown limited value in countering terrorism and is not sustainable from a policy perspective. Let's look at that limited value first. What are they referring to? Because I could see people that are in favor of the NSA data collection saying, well, it's always really hard to prove prevention.
Well, but we haven't seen, if the administration really had cases of where this has just helped them enormously. I mean, why didn't they come forward with that and say, this has helped us stop X, Y, and Z attacks? I also think the opposite may be true, that the mountain of material that they're getting here, it's a needle in a billion haystacks now, not just a needle in a single haystack. And so it's going to be harder and harder for them really to figure out what's going on, because of the vast amounts of data they're collecting from totally innocent people, because after all, if you're grabbing everybody's in a country of 300 million people, you're grabbing 299,990,000 people who are absolutely pure as the driven snow. And so that's not a very efficient system.
And so in that way, it really doesn't seem sustainable either.
I think that's what the committee met when they said it's not sustainable, just because I don't think it's helping them do their job, which is the rationale for it. But even if it was helping them do their job, I mean, we need to also be cognizant of our liberties and when our government is taking our liberties away. And this is a case where our government's been taking our liberties away. And then we need to have an argument about whether that's the country we want to live in. It was interesting when President Obama gave his NSA speech recently, he tried to play both sides to the middle, which is a traditional President Obama strategy. He was saying he was a big defender of our civil liberties, and this was an issue we really needed to talk about, and that he himself had raised the issue a week or a month before Edward Snowden surfaced. But we wouldn't be having this conversation today. He wanted to give him this NSA speech a couple of weeks ago if it weren't for Edward Snowden. And I think we need to take our hat off to Edward Snowden and thank him for being this courageous whistleblower. He didn't do it anonymously. He came forward and said, this was me. I'm leaking it because I think the country needs to know that its rights are being violated. And so we are having that conversation now, right now, and also president is having it. This NSA oversight board is having it. Congress is having it. The courts are looking into it, all because of Glenn Greenwald and Edward Snowden. Mm-hmm.
This is obviously a big story, but MSNBC decided that there was something even more important to cover. Anchor Andrea Mitchell was in the middle of interviewing Representative Jane Harman of California, who was speaking from the 2014 World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, when this happened. Let's take a listen to that.
Seriously consider not continuing Section 15.
Congresswoman, let me interrupt you just for a moment. We've got some breaking news out of Miami. Stand by, if you will. Right now in Miami, Justin Bieber has been arrested on a number of charges. The judge is reading the charges, including resisting arrest and driving under the influence. He's appearing now before the judge for his bond hearing. Let's watch.
Matt Rothschild.
Well, there you have it. That's the corporate media in this day and age where huge corporations run our media not to give us the news, but to sell advertising and do entertainment. And this was entertainment at the lowest level, I might add. But it's embarrassing. It's appalling. And Andrea Mitchell, I'm sure when she went home at night, you know, had to take a shower and wash her mouth out because it was awful that she did. I'm sure she had a producer yelling in her ear that we got a cut, and she... Mm-hmm. She couldn't have wanted to do that, but there she did it. And I also was struck along these same lines by a very wise comment that, a little bit snarky, that U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Powers, sent out on Twitter after this whole Justin Bieber thing surfaced and everyone seemed to be talking about it. And it just said, Justin Bieber, question mark. And then she said, Sudan, Middle East, Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And that was it.
Yeah.
But she was pointing out that, look, there are a lot more important things out here.
Well, and she should be happy. We are actually going to talk about South Sudan coming up in the 2 o'clock hour. And actually tying into what you just said about corporate media, there was an email from listener Sheila. She said, another problem with the very large income and wealth inequality is the way it distorts the market. Producers make so much more money making products for the very wealthy and have no incentive to provide for the needs of the less well-off. Housing is one example, but there are plenty more. And she wonders if you would agree with that.
You know, Sheila has raised a really interesting point that not many people picked up on, and that is during the Great Recession, if you looked at the advertisements that were out there, or the advertisements in The New Yorker, for instance, the advertisements were for the total 1%. New Mercedes, fancy $40,000 watch, diamond rings. There weren't, you know, ads for Corollas or for Hondas or for anything at the lower end of the consumer middle class mass market. And it's true. And I think right now we're in a stage where big capital, the huge corporations that cater to the upper end of the market, they don't really need the middle class anymore. And so while GM needs the middle class and Walmart needs the middle class, a lot of the profit makers don't need the middle class and aren't catering to the middle class anymore. And there's another problem with economic inequality, and that is just it's just bad for the economy. And so we've had report after report coming out about this. You talked about the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. They just put out a report last week saying it's the biggest threat to the world economy. The fact that the middle class and the lower class is just taking one hit after another. It's taking consumer demand, consumer purchasing power out of the world economy. And if that doesn't get fixed, the economy is going to go back into a big recession. I mean, how many more reports do we need? I mean, Stanford put out a similar report within the last month, and we've had report after report after report. It's not that we don't know that. We know that. The economic policymakers know that. Ben Bernanke knows it. And I'm sure Yellen knows it, too, his successor. And it's just when are the policymakers going to do something meaningful about that? And perhaps President Obama will talk about that tomorrow night in a State of the Union address.
I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn. This is All Things Political. We are visiting today with Matt Rothschild. He is the senior editor of The Progressive Magazine, a well-known commentator on national events. And we would appreciate and enjoy your joining in the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. Again, 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. And let's go to Peggy in Milwaukee next. Hi, Peggy.
Hi.
Hi.
I agree with everything that Mr. Rothschild says, and he says it so articulately. I think, though, the real problem is that we can talk about, liberals can talk about issues, and people are concerned about where our politics are going until we're blue in the face, but unless we change the tenor of our society so that we are involved in politics, I mean in the good parts of politics, actively involved in issues every single day of our lives, and make that less of a more like of a once every 4 year issue and personality driven political involvement, we have to find a way to get everybody in the United States more involved in politics on a daily basis so that we can affect change. If it's once every 4 years, we'll never be able to accomplish anything.
Thanks for that call, Peggy. Matt?
Peggy's absolutely right. I mean, once every 4 years, that's just a plebiscite kind of democracy. And we need an active democracy. I don't want to tell people they need to do it every single day because that may seem too daunting. But if people do it, you know, once a week, 10 hours a week, 5 hours a week, 5 hours a month, certainly more than, you know, 1 hour going to the voting booth or less every 2 years or every 4 years. That's not how we sustain a democracy, because otherwise the people who have the power and the money and the lobbyists, they're doing it every day. I mean, I used to work for Ralph Nader, and you know, he's a workaholic, and he kind of wanted us all to be workaholics too, so that, you know, if we weren't working on a Saturday, for instance, he, you know, he'd call up and say, well, you know, GM's working today and stuff like that. I mean, that may be taking it to an extreme, but we do need to get involved and in the streets. And there are some exciting things happening where I think Peggy might take some hope, and that is this effort by low-wage workers to strike and demand higher wages, $15 an hour, in fact, in many places. 350.org, the group that's trying to fight global warming, has lined up a whole mess of colleges and universities around the country, and student activists are getting involved in ways that haven't happened really since the anti-apartheid days. So I think those are two exciting demonstrations of how people are getting involved. Certainly the Occupy movement was an exciting kind of a comet in the sky there that burned out a little bit too early, but it shed light on this huge problem of inequality that we're talking about and that the president has started to talk about. And I think it's been the issue, and it's been out there for a long time. Robert Reich has talked about it. In fact, he's got a movie, Inequality for All, which is going to air at the Barrymore Theater in Madison on February 13th. He's been talking about it a lot. Bill Moyers has been talking a lot about it. Jim Hightower talks a lot about it. But it's funny, you know, it takes a little more than just talking and talking about it to get the attention of the public. And sometimes it just takes guts. Sometimes it just says, let's go occupy Wall Street. And then, you know, it can light a fire. And so I just encourage people, you know, Howard Zinn, the great historian, author of A People's History of the United States, says we never know when things are going to change. We never know the exact timing that change is going to happen. But unless we do something, we can be pretty assured that things aren't going to happen very fast. And that so we have to get out there and do what we do, hoping that at some point things are going to catch on. It's like fighting apartheid in South Africa. I mean, there were people who were fighting apartheid for years and years, not knowing when the end was going to come, but sensing morally that it had to come. And sure enough, morally, it had to come.
All right, let's go next to Margie in Milwaukee. Hi, Margie.
Hi. I don't know where to start because I agree with everything that you're saying, but I think at least a big part of the problem lies in the fact that the people that are being hurt the most have the least information about it. There's a disparity in terms of, you know, if you think of the low income and the middle income, how hard they're working. They're like, you know, like on a treadmill, and they can't get off. They work one, two, three jobs. They're taking care of their kids after school, maybe there's, and they don't have time to watch multiple news shows, read papers, maybe buy the subscriptions of the reputable magazines, and get a clear picture, not to mention how some politicians change their opinion within 2 hours. And to be able to see, oh my gosh, he just did a double take on what he'd said before. It took me months to try and get on top of things in 08 or 07 when I started to become aware of the difference between candidates and the parties. And it took me a long time. I listened to shows over and over and over again when I was unemployed and had the time to do it.
I think that's a great point, Margie. And Matt, I think what Margie is really getting at is there is a certain luxury of time to be politically aware, to stay on top of the issues, to be able to sort through a lot of conflicting information.
There is, and some people who get a lot of information from Fox, are, for instance, are getting a lot of bad information because there are studies out that show the more you watch Fox News, the less you actually know what's accurately going on. It's not just an information deficit, though, because in people's heart of hearts, they know some basic things. They know that corporations have too much power over our economy and over our democratic system, too. And they also sense that the system just simply doesn't work for them. And that is, in a sense, depoliticizing. And it's too bad that people don't, who feel that way, don't involve themselves more. But when the odds are so stacked against them, it's hard to tell them to involve themselves more when there's no obvious benefit for them in the short term. I think President Obama has helped some people in the short term with the Affordable Care Act, but he had the power in his first 2 years anyway to help people on the low end by raising the minimum wage. And he didn't push that through the democratically controlled Congress, or to help people join unions. He didn't push through the Employee Free Choice Act, which would help people join unions. So here you had a president who was campaigning on huge promises of hope and change. And for a lot of people on the south end of the income and wealth scale, they weren't getting it, whereas the banks continued to get bailed out. So the it's not so much a lack of information. I think people get that they're getting the shaft here, and it's just a question of how do you affect change, and that's a real riddle.
We are talking with Matt Rothschild, senior editor of The Progressive Magazine. This is All Things Political. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We are going to talk about the recent Republican National Committee meeting and what came out of that. We'll also look a little bit ahead this week at the congressional Republicans heading into their retreat and also the State of the Union address. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Coming up at 2 o'clock, we will talk about the crisis in South Sudan and try to figure out what the issues are there and what possible solutions might be. But right now, it's All Things Political with Matt Rothschild of The Progressive Magazine and your calls at 1-800-642-1234. Matt, the Republican National Committee meeting just wrapped up at the end of the week. A year ago, RNC Chairman Rens Priebus published a report aimed at saying that he wanted to modernize the party and boost its ranks. How successful would you say he's been?
I don't think he's been very successful. The Republican Party has come out as the party against comprehensive immigration reform, and this was a big push by the RNC, Rance Priebus. Karl Rove was big on this, reaching out to Latino voters, and they've done just the opposite, so that Latino voters are going 2 out of 3 to Democrats now, and if that continues, it's a real hard problem. And then you had, this question of how civilized they're being toward women, for instance, shall I say. And we've had this Mike Huckabee comment that was just outrageous. I mean, I remember after the last election and the horrible comments that some Republican candidates for Senate were making about women. And I heard one Republican consultant say, you know, if they mention women and rape one more time, I'm going to slap them. And so it's just they still seem tone deaf. Many of them still seem tone deaf.
Well, and going back to the Mike Huckabee comment for people that might not have heard it, he said that Democrats, quote, insult the women of America by making them believe that they are helpless without Uncle Sugar coming in and providing for them a prescription each month for birth control because they cannot control their libido or their reproductive system without the help of government. And we should say that there were many Republicans that were backing away from that statement pretty quickly.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he treats women as though they're a different species. And that kind of condescension, I think, for more than 50% of the public has got to be offensive. And it can't help the Republican Party going forward, certainly.
You mentioned comprehensive immigration reform. And interestingly, last week, the Arizona Republican Party formally censured Senator John McCain on Saturday, citing a voting record they say is insufficiently conservative and immigration reform, along with not working to defund the Affordable Care Act, were at the top of that list.
Yeah, I mean, John McCain is a moderate in these days in the Republican Party, insufficiently conservative. I mean, if they're going to have a, you know, a kind of ideological litmus test over there, if they're going to have, you know, purge trials within the Republican Party such that they're going to get rid of John McCain, it's going to be a smaller and smaller party. We may also see a third party not from the left but from the right, that the Republican Party may split off. I mean, here we have had over the last couple of months the U.S. Chamber of Commerce saying it's going to run candidates against Tea Party candidates. So there's this war going on within the Republican Party that's kind of fascinating to watch from the sidelines.
Well, and looking just a little ahead to tomorrow's State of the Union address, there will be the usual Republican response, and this time it will be given by House Republican Conference Chair Representative Kathy McMorris Rodgers from Washington State. She's actually the first woman to give the Republican response in over a decade. But there will also be a Tea Party response, and that's by Utah Republican Senator Mike Lee. He was actually one of the leading architects of last year's government shutdown. What does it say about the Republican Party that they can't even respond, or they choose not to respond to the State of the Union address in a unified manner?
Yeah, it's just they're just hopelessly divided right now. And there's a real question as to who's going to run the show. Is it going to be the Tea Party, or is it going to be, you know, big business, which is the U.S. Chamber of Commerce? I mean, when the U.S. Chamber of Commerce gets so upset, and we saw John Boehner, the Speaker of the House, about a month ago getting so upset that they denounce factions within their own party. You know, they've come a long way from when Ronald Reagan said no one should say ill of another Republican if you're a Republican.
Let's go to Kathy in Waupaca next. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Love your magazine, by the way, Matt.
Well, thank you.
I think talk radio and the right-wing media in general has done a fine job of dividing working people by the old reliable standbys, by race, which unfortunately should not even be an issue in 2014, but it still is, and by union or non-union membership. We hear this all the time, well, union people lazy, union, 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 bad, bad, bad. You know, the United States had its most prosperous period in the 1950s when union membership was at its highest. I should say my husband is not a union member, although he definitely supports the concept of unions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kathy. Matt?
Well, I do think this division over cultural issues has been a strategy of the Republican Party since Richard Nixon's Southern strategy, anyway, in his so-called war on crime. And the race card has been played subtly and not so subtly in one election after another by many Republicans, not all. Certainly, we need to figure out how to reach people on the basic bread and butter economic issues. And this is what Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont is constantly saying. He is trying to talk to people where they are, where they're sitting at their kitchen table, going over their bills once a week or once a month, saying, we need to do better by you. The Republicans are doing worse by you, and some corporate Democrats aren't doing much better by you either. And we got to do better as a society by you. And certainly we need to support unions. I mean, one of the reasons we have greater inequality in this country, which is what we've been talking about through much of this hour, Judith, is the decline in union membership. Now stands at about 11%. It used to be in the 1950s when we had a roaring economy that it was around 35%. And in the private sector, it's about 7% right now. The corporations have won in the private sector, largely. It's not a done deal. It's not over. It's a constant struggle. And there's union organizing going on at Walmart, which will be a huge battle, and in other workplaces. But certainly unions help people raise their own standard of living and help people who aren't in the union but who are in nearby companies raise their standard of living, too, because if a company sees the union shop paying much better to attract good people, they need to start paying the same kind of wages and giving the same kind of benefits.
It's interesting, Matt, early on in the program today, we were talking about income inequality and how the U.S. compares, especially to Western Europe, in economic mobility. And you just brought up very low numbers of union membership in the U.S. The average in the European Union states, and some of those would be much higher and some much lower, is at 23%. And we were saying that there is much more economic mobility in those European countries as well.
Yeah, and that's no accident. I mean, in all these studies that came out, the Stanford study that came out, World Economic Forum studies that come out, other studies about inequality, almost all of them say that one of the reasons for greater inequality is the decline of union power. And so the obverse is necessary that we need to increase the number of people in unions, make it easier to unionize. I mean, let's face it. There are corporations breaking the law in the United States every day, breaking the labor law. They are firing union organizers. That is against the law. It happens all the time, and there's virtually no penalty for it. I mean, at most, a little slap on the wrist or a tiny little fine, and every corporation that busts a union is saying, if they catch me, which is unlikely, big deal.
You can join in All Things Political at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn, talking with Matt Rothschild of the Progressive Magazine. And Agnes in Boscobel has something to say about corporations as well. Let's go there. Hi, Agnes.
Hi.
Hi.
Yes, what I'm having concern about is the power of the big corporations. And a lot of this goes back to the 1970s when they sent out a proxy business that asked people to vote whether there should be one vote, one shareholder, one vote, like there used to be, which sounds like democracy to me, or if it should be one share, one vote. And the answer, of course, came back, it was one share, one vote. So that the executives of the companies were getting paid shares as part of their salary and part of their bonuses, maybe all their bonuses. And so it isn't too long before they own all of their shares or the majority of the shares, so they can decide what they want, which direction they want the company to go. They appoint the board of directors in actuality, and the board of directors decide on the salaries and bonuses for everybody. And so that's why they're having such huge, huge salaries.
Thanks for that call, Agnes. Matt?
You know, Agnes has picked up on something that I didn't know until this year. I found it out because one of my sons is an economics major at the University of Wisconsin and was taking a course on the U.S. corporation, on capitalism in the United States. And the professor here gave a lecture and also passed out readings that said exactly this, that it used to be in the early ages of capitalism in the United States in the 1800s, even past the Civil War, and then things started to get consolidated, that there was one shareholder, one vote, which was a much more democratic way to do it. And so that the richest person doesn't have tremendous power over the corporation. But yes, now we have one share, one vote in every corporation that I know of. And so the person who holds the most shares gets the most power. The idea that the shareholders, as this huge group of millions of people owning shares in a single company, that the shareholders at large run the company is a joke. The person with the most shares runs the company, and often it is the CEO who has gotten enormous numbers of shares and has enormous power in not only running the company, but giving himself a tremendous salary and a golden parachute when he leaves.
We are talking with Matt Rothschild of the Progressive Magazine. This is All Things Political. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn. Matt, just to wrap up on the Republican National Committee meeting, one of the decisions that did come out of that is to shorten their primary season. What was the impetus for that decision?
Well, I think, again, this is going to help the candidate who's the best funded, the person who can put on the most ads in the early states and come out of the early states of the big league and then wrap it up quickly so you don't have a long divisive run. So, you know, it's going to help whoever the front runner is. It's hard to say who the front runner is after Chris Christie's debacle, but maybe it's still him. Or maybe Bush is going to come out of Florida and run. Who knows?
Let's go and talk about another race in which there may or may not be much of a primary. Scott in New Glarus has something to ask about the upcoming governor's race. Hi, Scott.
Good afternoon. I'm wondering if Matt could speak to the upcoming governor's race and what Mary Burke might do to stake out a whole different set of priorities and issues and, how she might do that.
Thanks, Scott, for the call. Well, I wish you would stake those out clearly because I haven't heard her do so yet. I don't know Mary Burke. I've never met her, actually. I know some people who know her and talk very highly of her. And yet there is this thirst at the grassroots of the Democratic Party in Wisconsin for a real fighting progressive. And some of those people wanted Kathleen Vinehout to run, and she just took herself out last week. I think people were a little distressed by that because now it looks like the candidate that the party brokers have chosen is the only candidate. I actually think that there should be a primary, that we need more choices for one thing. And Mary Burke needs the batting practice. I mean, she isn't an experienced politician. She's on the school board here in Madison. She was head of the Commerce Department under Governor Doyle, but that didn't give her the practice there in the batting cage when they're throwing fastballs at you and you got to swing and try to hit that ball. And she's going to get a lot of fastballs thrown at her head during this campaign. I mean, Walker and the Republicans in the state, they play for keeps and they'll play dirty. And she's got to be ready for it. And I just don't know a better way to get a candidate ready than to have them run in a primary. So I'm still hoping another candidate's going to throw his or her hat in the ring for that reason alone.
Well, I think I agree with you, Matt. In any election, some issues only get brought up if there is a primary and if there are a variety of candidates, not all, you know, not so similar to each other that it's hard to kind of tease out who's for what. But some issues will only be brought up if there's a robust primary, I think.
Yeah, and look at Barack Obama. Here is a guy who lost 19 out of 20 debates in the Democratic primaries. And finally, he got to be a good debater and he beat the crap out of John McCain. Mary Burke, she needs to get some of those skills. I don't know if she has those skills yet.
Let's go back to the phones and Ray in Milwaukee. Hi, Ray.
Hi. I want to address a caller a few calls back who mentioned she thought that the Republicans were responsible for splitting union workers from non-union workers. And I'm a union worker myself, 14 years in a union, proud union member. I'd like to remind that lady that regularly across the United States, union workers, by a two-thirds majority, vote conservative, which kind of blew my mind. Maybe not so in Wisconsin, but across the country, two-thirds of union voters vote conservative. And Matt Rothschild, as far as rubbing your hands in glee over what's going on with the Republican Party, at least they have one branch that's split off. It's called the Tea Party, which is trying to stand up for something. And the Democrats are about to see the same thing happen with them. People in my union, nobody is talking positive about Hillary Clinton, the anointed next king of this country. And we really are disgusted with Mr. Obama. We voted for him twice. He did not come to this state and put feet on the ground here when we needed him. If he'd have made a speech in Milwaukee and Madison before the recall election, we would not have Scott Walker in there. But he made a political decision that he wanted to win the presidency back and let, what, a million and a half Wisconsin union members lose their unions.
Okay, Ray, I'm going to hold you there so Matt has time to respond.
Well, I actually agree with Ray here about President Obama and not coming to the state. I mean, he couldn't find Wisconsin with a Google map and a flashlight. I see he's coming to Wisconsin later this week. He must have gotten those things in the meantime. It was outrageous he didn't come here. And I totally agree with you that I think you've got your facts wrong on union workers voting two-thirds for conservatives. The numbers I have in my head show that it's about one-third for conservatives. But, the Democrats there may be a split coming up in the Democratic Party. And to me, that's fine. Let's have four parties. Why do we need two parties? Let's have a right-wing Tea Party. Let's have a corporate Republican Party. Let's have a corporate Democratic Party. And let's have a real progressive fourth party.
We had another caller who wondered how unions can be really progressive or democratic when immigration reform seems to be in conflict with the needs of unions and union workers. How would you respond to that?
Well, actually, the unions have come a long way on this issue over the last 10 years and now are some of the biggest supporters of comprehensive immigration reform because they know that an economy that's exploiting immigrant workers isn't an economy that's good for workers anywhere.
Well, Matt, in just the minute we have left, what are you hoping to hear in the State of the Union address tomorrow?
Well, he's got such diminished power. It's hard to know what he's going to come out for. The big thing I'd hope for is we need to increase the minimum wage. If Congress is going to set an increase in the minimum wage, I'm going to, as President of the United States, require every company that does business with the U.S. government to pay a living wage of $10 or more.
All right. Matt Rothschild, senior editor of The Progressive Magazine, a well-known commentator on all kinds of things, including civil liberties. Matt, thanks so much for joining us today.
Judith, it's been a real pleasure.
This is All Things Political. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn today, and happy to have you along. Coming up after the news, we are going to talk about South Sudan, and we are going to figure out, hopefully, what's going on there and how the world governments and people can support the people of South Sudan. Coming up at this time tomorrow, we are going to take a look at another part of the world. We're going to talk about Ukraine and the conflicts that are going on there and what it means for the people of Ukraine. I hope you'll stay tuned. A lot more coming up on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.